The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful website building platform. As a Guardian podcast listener, it goes without saying that you're a clever clogs. The good news is that building your own professional website with Squarespace is easy. Whether the site you need is for a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog, getting started takes seconds. Go to squarespace.com today and show support for this podcast and get 10% off. Use the offer code Guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, we'll look at how computing has developed from a cumbersome, largely mathematical pursuit involving roomfuls of equipment into the portable phenomenon that surrounds us today that we can't imagine life without. Tony Hay is the co-author of The Computing Universe, a book charting the evolution of computers from Babbage, Lovelace and Turing, throwing forward to the potential of AI and computational thinking. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Tony Hay is a prolific writer and academic who spent the first part of his career working in particle physics before switching to computer science. Until recently, he was Microsoft Research's vice president, responsible for the company's worldwide university research collaborations. With Giuri Pape, he's written The Computing Universe, newly published by Cambridge University Press. It explains the key concepts that make today's computers work and highlights the milestones in computing history, along with the lesser-known people that played such crucial roles. The book also looks forward to where computing may be headed next, and it explores the notion of computational thinking, the potential to use fundamental computing concepts to solve difficult non-computing problems. I started by asking Tony what prompted him to write this book.
I wrote this book because I'm a little dissatisfied by the popular science books that are out there. They're great, but they're typically aimed at sort of, you know, the interested reader, middle-aged, educated, and so on. And I wanted something that would be appealing to a nerdy teenager. It needed to be visually appealing, and it needed actually to have color pictures and things like that throughout, rather than just a bunch of text, then a little insert of black and white photos, a bunch of text, black and white photos. And that's the traditional science book, and it's fine, I like them, but I wanted really to get through to the teenagers to excite them into originally to physics. So I did a quantum universe book of this type, which was inspired by Feynman's lectures on quantum mechanics at Cornell. It's very different. It has all the pictures through it. You can just look at the pictures if you want to, and the captions are important. But it was intending to capture people's interest. And just occasionally, I have students who come up to me and say, "You're the reason I did physics." So it doesn't happen all the time, but it is nice when it does happen. And Feynman said about that book, "The Quantum Universe has a quotation from me in every chapter, but it's still a damn good book." So Feynman was a hero of mine. But what is not known is that for the last 5 years of his life, he lectured on computing. He moved to computing just like I did. And he asked me to write up his lectures just before he died. And so the Feynman's lectures on computing exist, and they're a sort of graduate level text. But he has also a very interesting way of explaining what computers are really all about. And he gave a talk at this holistic therapy center called Esalen on Big Sur in California to a very eclectic audience. It was called Computers from the Inside Out. And I really felt that I wanted to give a sort of Feynman approach of explaining what computers could do, what they couldn't do, and how they came to be in a way that would excite kids. And that's really why the book is the way it is.
When I was born, there was no internet, no email, no one had computers lying around at home. But there's now this whole generation of people who don't know a world without the web. And I'm wondering if this is some kind of attempt to say to those people, look, this is how we got here.
Yes, exactly that. It's an attempt to explain how we got where we are, you know, all the history. I couldn't resist putting some history in. I've tried to put it in the appendix of each chapter, but yes, it's telling you who did what and how it came about, and contrasting, for example, the British obsessive secrecy. You know, we had the first vacuum tube computer. It was called Colossus. It had 1,500 tubes. We made 10 of them at Bletchley Park. not to solve Enigma, but to solve the Lorentz Code, which was used by Hitler and the German High Command. But after the war, Churchill insisted that 8 of the 10 were destroyed, 2 were moved to what became GCHQ, and he ordered the plans of Tommy Flowers to be burnt. And nobody knew about it. As a contrast, the Americans, with the ENIAC and von Neumann, they allowed people to use it. And as a result, everything followed the American model.
I want to go back to that time when we sort of had the advent of computing, and it spawned a lot of science fiction back in the day. When you look at the reality of modern computing, how does it compare with the ideas that people were coming up with in fiction?
Yes, I couldn't resist adding a little essay at the end, Computers and Science Fiction. It starts with a quote from Malcolm Bradbury saying the one thing that they all missed, and they all thought computers were going to be like the ENIAC, you see, taking up a whole building and a room, and more powerful computers would get bigger and bigger. And so they had, you know, computers the size of a planet and things like that. But they all missed the micro-miniaturization, the microprocessor, all except one, actually. There was one, a logic named Joe, which was actually very percipient and perceptive and really captured what would be described now as network computers. It had computers, a rogue computer, which became intelligent. And when you asked it, you know, how to kill your wife, it gave you an answer. So it was actually that, but that's the only one. All the other science fiction writers, like Asimov and Vonnegut, had computers getting bigger and bigger. Asimov was interesting because he was slightly schizophrenic because he also had robots. And obviously in the robot, the computer's really, really tiny, but he hadn't actually put that together. So he had robots with tiny computers, which he didn't call computers, and he had computers the size of a planet. Again, there's an interesting contrast between the Americans' Star Trek, which boldly goes, and, of course, the English series Red Dwarf, which I would say cowardly drifts. And, you know, the English always had the sort of light-hearted, you know, take on the Discworld and of course Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, as opposed to the more serious American view.
Why do you think that was, that we had this different take from Britain? Because I was noticing in the book you quote a bit out of Red Dwarf with Holly, the kind of the AI on board, talking about a purple alert and no one knowing what a purple alert is, and she said, "Oh, I didn't want to say mauve alert." And it is different to a lot of. The style is very different to a lot of the science fiction you would have seen coming out of the US.
Yes, no, I agree. I mean, hard SF typifies the science fiction in the US. Why is it? Well, I think it's because in England we make fun of ourselves very often, and I don't think that's the case in America. They take themselves a bit more seriously.
You inevitably in the book go through the contributions of Babbage, Lovelace, Turing. Could we have got where we are today without them?
Yes. Yes, I think there's a paper by Morris Wilkes from Cambridge who says that the contributions on the modern computer had very little impact. Actually, I think that's slightly unfair. So Turing and Babbage and Ada, they had lots of ideas, but actually the practical things came from America and came from the ENIAC and stuff like that. Ultimately, the EDVAC, which Wilkes built a version of that at Cambridge. In fact, he built it before any of the Americans because he had a secret weapon. He had an astrophysicist called Tommy Gold. He's the guy who discovered what pulsars were, rotating neutron stars. But during the war, he'd been working on radar where you had to delay a signal to compare two signals to see if anything had moved. So they used mercury delay lines. And they'd been suggested for computer storage, but they were difficult to build. But Gold had been building them all the war. So he knew all about it, and he built them for Wilkes and showed Wilkes how to build them. But no, I think Babbage and Ada Lovelace were fascinating things, and I like the science fiction book, you know, The Difference Engine, which what happens if Babbage's machine had been made. And it's a very interesting example of some of our concerns about privacy in that book, if the Victorians had built these computing engines and stuff like that. But I don't think they had any impact on modern computers, actually. They did prefigure modern computers, but I don't think they had the impact.
You talked about Tommy Flowers at Bletchley Park and another Tommy Gold. Are there other characters in the book that are also less well-known than the sort of the usual names we associate with computing?
Well, again, on writing it up, I couldn't resist doing some history. And actually, I do believe that the Cambridge group, this is Maurice Wilkes and his team, get rather little credit in the scheme of things. The first graduate student in computer science is a guy named David Wheeler, who was in Wilkes's team. They realized that writing in machine code ones and zeros was getting pretty difficult, and they realized they're going to spend a lot of their time debugging programs. So they invented a sort of basic assembler, and he wrote the first assembler program, which converted that into machine code and loaded it. So it was called initial orders. But the other thing that they discovered was, you know, if you'd worked out the programming to do matrix multiply, and it worked, you didn't want everybody else to have to go through the same debugging, so you wanted a library of these things that you could slot into your code. And so they developed subroutine libraries. And to do that, you had to have from where you are in the program, you had to go to where the library was, go through the library, execute it, then jump back into the program at the right place. And this was called the Wheeler jump. And again, David Wheeler was one of the first pioneers, and I guess his name is not known to very many. Actually, Wheeler, Gill, and Wilkes wrote one of the first books on programming, which actually was a very early book on how you could program computers. So I think there are quite a few little curious features. I also don't know how many people know about the Alto, which was Xerox PARC's machine, which was built by Butler Lampson, Chuck Thacker, and Alan Kay. But you know, they had everything. They had everything we have now. They had the mouse, they had the icons, they had pull-down menus, all these sort of things, windows and everything else. The only thing they didn't have was the spreadsheet, but everything else they had.
And what were they doing with the computer?
Butler Lampson is a very smart Turing Award winner, worked for Microsoft Research now. He understood Moore's Law. So he understood it was prohibitively expensive to build the machine they were building when they built it. It cost a lot of money for the memory. But he knew that in a few years it would be really affordable. So he understood that Moore's Law was going to come and make these things really affordable. And they built the first computer, sat under a desk, and you could link it. They also invented Ethernet. So they had this whole thing linked up. They invented laser printers. And there's a story that Chuck Thacker told me about Butler Lampson's wife. She was submitting her thesis to Stanford. She brought her two copies to the admin building and said, I'm submitting my thesis. And they said, thank you very much. Which one is the original that needs to go to the library? And she said, no, they're printed by laser printer. They're the same. And the guy wouldn't have anything of it. No, I need to have the original. And in the end, she said that one because, you know, it was too difficult to fight. No one had heard of laser printers. So they did a remarkable stuff. It's absolutely amazing. And of course, they took up the ideas of Doug Engelbart with the mouse. And Doug Engelbart is also a fairly unsung hero, deserves a bit more credit than he sometimes gets.
I wanted to ask about how we got from some places to where we are now. And I'm thinking particularly around, I remember the extraordinary excitement when computers like the ZX80 and ZX81 came on the market from Sinclair and these other small home computers that then started coming on the market. And we've now got far more computing power than that on our mobile phones, and it happened extremely fast. I just wondered if it's possible to pick out the key advances that enabled that transition from those very simple and not very powerful home computers to what we have now.
It really all started with the microprocessor, Intel's microprocessor, which was the beginning of a computer on a chip. I mean, and they didn't really understand how useful, how universal it was in machines, in cars, but also in personal computers. And that's why you have to give credit to people like Paul Allen and Bill Gates with the Altair, where they wrote the first basic compiler, and to Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak with the Apple computer. They were the first people who realized that you could use microprocessors to build things that could do interesting things. You could do graphics, you could write games. So there was this big hobbyist movement. And it is curious that all the professional computer science and the computing industry sort of all missed this. And that's where the Sinclair Spectrum came from and all these other things. People found they could write games, and they wrote some really super games. I remember Space Invaders and all these sort of things. It was a remarkable revolution. made possible by the microprocessor and the personal computer, which was done by the hobbyists originally, not by the professionals.
You talk in the book about Moore's law and inevitably, and you know, the idea of the number of transistors on a chip doubling every year or 18 months. Presumably that can't carry on forever, though, or can it?
No, you know that I'm a physicist, and eventually you get down to where individual atoms are involved, and things at the microscopic level behave in very different ways. So we are getting close to getting down to where quantum effects, the systems will not behave in the same way. So that's one of the problems. The other problem is you can put lots more transistors on a chip and you can make it smaller, but actually getting power to the chip. So we now have this phenomenon of dark silicon, where you have lots of processors on the chip, but you can't afford to light them up. Either you can't get power to it, or if you put too much power on the chip, it'll melt. So we have real problems in actually increasing the power of a chip. So I think Moore's law, in terms of power, is certainly finished. In terms of density, I think you can go perhaps another round or two, but then we're going to have to see what happens. Maybe it becomes like air flight. You know, airplanes now, they run 600 miles an hour and they don't go any faster. We don't bother to go supersonic. And maybe computers will be the same. Maybe we've actually reached the asymptote and Moore's law will end. And that changes a lot of things. One of the things I spent my time doing was parallel computing, getting lots of computers working on the same problem together. And I think that's a piece of the answer. But yes, in the book I discuss, you know, some of the possible technologies that may take over when you get down to the atomic level. Things like Richard Feynman, again, yeah. He gave a dinner lecture 50-odd years ago called Plenty of Room at the Bottom, which was what happens if you actually manipulated things an atom at a time. And, you know, didn't need any new physics. We can do that, but we hadn't got round to doing it. And so we are now getting round to doing it. You have things like graphene, which was actually Nobel Prize discovered in Manchester, one atom thick. We can make clever devices out of that and carbon nanotubes and things like this. But we then would have to go from silicon to carbon, and that's a big change. But that's one possibility, and then there are more exotic ones like biological computing and quantum computing. But I don't think those will ever be mainstream. So I think we're going to have trouble finding a mainstream replacement for silicon and Moore's law.
I wanted to ask you about graphene, actually, because the problem with that in terms of a silicon substitute is that it's hard to make it switchable, isn't it?
People claim to have done so. I haven't actually studied the thing in detail, but I think that it is a promising thing that you can do very surprising things with it. And I think that people will eventually make some very interesting devices using graphene. So I'm optimistic about that.
You mentioned Jeanette Wing's notion of computational thinking in the book and how this might become important in education. So I wonder if you can take our listeners through what computational thinking is and how it actually could be used, if at all, in schools.
Yes, the GCSE that my kids did, three kids, that was different every year in ICT, and they were bored stiff. It was teaching them what I would call digital literacy, how to use a word processor, how to use a spreadsheet, how to make a PowerPoint presentation, for example. And they found it completely boring. And that's really, really depressing as an educator. It's one of the most exciting fields ever. And what do? We make it completely boring. So now you see this big move. In the States, it's called code.org, which is about teach people to program. Well, that's okay, too. That's a good thing. But actually, you need more than that. You have to have something worthwhile to program. And that's really what computational thinking is about. It's about the fact that computer scientists, you know, if I want to go from A to B, how do I pick the shortest route? Well, we all know that. You just use your GPS. Well, that depends on these routing algorithms. And you need to know, is that the fastest routing algorithm, one that was better, quicker, faster, use less memory? All these sort of issues are the sort of things that are computational thinking. You think about physicists just make things that work. Computer scientists tend to say, is that the best way? Could I make it differently? Are there different algorithms to do these things? And because of people like Turing and the formal basis for computer science, you can show that you can divide these algorithms into classes. So it is surprising. I've talked about routing algorithms. So a simple problem is a traveling salesman around the UK, could he go to every county town in the UK? What's the shortest route? And it sounds very trivial. But it turns out when you get large numbers of cities, it becomes essentially impossible. It would take the age of the universe to calculate. And so Are there approximations to that? Could you actually find an algorithm that would be, do it in a fast time? So there are all sorts of issues which really are computational thinking. You have to figure out how to use computers, what are the algorithms, and that's really what computer science is about. It's not about digital literacy, and programming is a sort of side feature. Yes, you need to do it, but you have to have something worthwhile to do. And that's why I'm very supportive of the computing at schools, and very supportive, actually, of the government's initiative to teach computing as a science like biology, chemistry, and physics. I think it's a very good thing because it's a key skill for actually keeping the UK competitive.
So this is about getting into the sort of the nitty-gritty of how algorithms work in so that that would become part of a sort of computer science lecturing and so on.
Yes, I mean, one of the things I give a popular lecture on the computing universe, one of the things is the billion-dollar algorithm. That was by Larry Page and Sergey Brin at Stanford. They invented an algorithm called PageRank, which actually was much, much better than any of the other search engines. I used to use a search engine called AltaVista. Nobody's heard of it today, all right? It can be truly transformative if you can work out an algorithm. My research team at Microsoft Research was applying machine learning to genetics, looking at genomes. They managed to find an algorithm which went from increasing as you increase the number of size of the problem, the time grows with the cube of the number of patients that you're looking at. And they've managed to change that to an algorithm which goes linear. And that's a huge change. Going from linear to cubic is a big change. So instead of being able only to analyze, 1,000 patients on your computer system, you can now do 100,000. And that makes much more easy to find subtle signals and things like that. So there are huge potential breakthroughs by actually studying algorithms and applying them in all sorts of interesting areas.
Are there a lot of urban myths that come up in computing that you come across looking through the history of all of this?
Yes, there are urban myths. Nice stories too, like the fact that Tim Berners-Lee's paper on the web was rejected by the Hypertext Conference as containing nothing new. And there's myths that, that Watson said the world has only need of 3 computers. I think there's no record of him actually saying that, but it's certainly a widely propagated myth. But just to pick up Tim Berners-Lee, he was the first one to marry hypertext, which actually came from another of the heroes, in my view, a guy named Vannevar Bush. After the war, he wrote 2 seminal papers. One was The Endless Frontier, which was about how research, because he'd been involved in the research at the Manhattan Project and things like that during the war, he'd seen how research can power an economy and defense and everything else. And so that led to the setting up of the National Science Foundation. But he also wrote a thing called As We May Think, which was how in the future we're going to be deluged by information and you need to follow trails through that literature. And that paper inspired Deng Engelbart, and it also inspired another character called Ted Nelson, who invented the word hypertext. And he had a system he was trying to do called Xanadu. And it had an interesting feature. It was like the web, but much more controlled. And also, if you went to a website and used it, he had this idea of micropayments. You got paid a bit. So, for example, one of the fears that I have is that the web is open, and I'm glad that it's open, but the fact that you can take anybody's content and you do what you like with it could be the death of things like journalism. It could be the death of things like music and all these other things, because you need to give reward to the creators, not just to the advertisers who want to sell you things. Ted Nelson had this idea of micropayments, but Tim Berners-Lee had the great insight, and I usually do it in the form of a rhyming couplet. If you want the web to scale, you must allow the links to fail. So the fact that all the links point back to a given site, you cannot impose on the owner of that site that he keep track of all the links pointing to his site. So sometimes it'll just go away, and you have error 404. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing that enabled things to scale. The hypertext community were trying not to have these sort of dangling links and things like that. But Tim Berners-Lee realized a sort of engineering compromise. Yes, you sometimes get error 404, but okay, but this scales, as you see, to billions of people. And Tim Berners-Lee really has made the web usable by ordinary mortals. That's something the computer science community had actually failed to grasp.
You're saying that it has to be more than the advertisers who benefit, and that you said that, you know, there may be threats to journalism, to music and things like that. You have people like Alex Pentland at MIT talking about a new deal on data whereby people get to retain some kind of ownership over the information that they put about themselves on the web. Do you think there is any hope for that kind of new deal?
I'm not sure that specific deal. A colleague of mine called Jaron Lanier, he's credited with inventing virtual reality, has written a couple of books. One is You Are Not a Gadget, in which is he points out the fact that you can rip off and mix and burn and anybody's content is the Web 2.0 philosophy, is the death of journalism and things. He also has another book called Who Owns the Future? I mean, one of the things in the book, you'll find that I talk about the dark side of the web, which is about viruses and all these sort of nasty things that are actually happening. But the last section is about cookies. When you go to a website, they say, can I use a cookie? And so you say yes, and that's okay. But they've also, on the page you're looking at, there may be all these advertisers, and they also send you cookies. And these third-party cookies, as they're termed, they send the information back to aggregators who actually aggregate and send you information. So I suddenly find that I was looking at data science courses for my nephew, and now I get lots of adverts for data science courses, because they sell this information to the advertisers. The actual content creators don't get their fair share. And so I think this is a serious problem, and how we attack it is not clear. But I do feel, you know, if you want people to have a living wage and be able to bring up a family and do things like quality journalism, speaking to a journalist, I think this is important. There's a terrifying book I just read by a guy named Dave Eggers. It's a science fiction book. It's called First Circle, and it's really about the death of privacy, the fact that you can make smaller and smaller microphones, radio-connected, internet-connected devices with cameras, and actually, in the end, you'll have no privacy. And it's rather like the fact that they're now equipping policemen with cameras on their vests so they can record everything that happens, and so, therefore, there can't be any sort of sleazy deals, because everything is recorded and visible, and so you can't have abuses. So it has some good sides, but it also has really some terrifying sides, that privacy in the way that we hold dear is actually being threatened by these technologies. So lots of challenges ahead, but that's always the way. That's why we need young, smart people to go and solve some of these problems.
Your book is largely about how we got where we are, and you've already started doing this, but I wonder if you could cast ahead to see how you see things shaping up. I mean, I think you talk about the Internet of Things. The world seems to have changed dramatically in the last 20, 30 years in terms of computing. What do you think is going to happen in the next, you know, 20, 30? What's coming along as far as you can guess?
Well, I was very much taken by Butler Lampson's characterization of computing. He calls it the three ages of computing. The first age, from about 1950 to 1980, computers were used largely for simulation, for doing calculations. So that's what they were built for, to simulate the atom bomb and things like that, and doing complex calculations, simulation. The second age is when we start to connect them up, and some computers for communication, and, you know, understanding how we use computers when they're connected up, like via the Internet and the World Wide Web, you know, gives you another set of applications. And he thinks now that's sort of 1980, 2010, and then from 2010 onwards, we're in what he calls the age of embodiment. What he means by that is now you see on your television adverts for high-end cars like BMW, Mercedes, and so on, which take action to avoid an accident before the driver can. They act on your behalf. So you'll have, let me call them intelligent systems, which realize you're going to have an accident and apply the brakes. And that's great. People would actually think that's a good idea. So I think you'll have lots of these sort of AI, artificial intelligence applications, which actually the machine really helps you do things. And it does things that you want. One of the examples I give from the science case is that there's a database in the National Library of Medicine in the US called PubMed. Three papers a minute, every minute of the year, are deposited in PubMed. There is no way on earth that scientists can keep up with three papers a minute being deposited. How can you find out what's important? You need help. And so at the time when MIT colleagues like Minsky and McCarthy were looking at artificial intelligence and real AI systems, JCR Licklider, who was a professor there, was doing what he called a human-computer symbiosis, and the fact that computers can assist people. So I do see the future. Yes, you'll have smart systems which emulate intelligence and really do things that help you, but you'll also have computers which actually assist human beings doing their jobs. And I think that's how I see AI going in the future. You'll see things becoming increasingly, quote, intelligent, unquote, in the form of assisting things rather than the traditional strong AI thinking robots like R2-D2 and C-3PO in Star Wars. So I think that you'll see a lot of these systems looking more intelligent. We're getting close to actually a three-year-old can tell the difference between a cat and a dog picture, but that's a very difficult thing for a computer to do. Well, we're getting better at that. And similarly, recognizing voices, computers are getting better at doing that. Not the same as humans, but they're getting much better and close to human capability.
Am I being a Luddite worrying about the vulnerabilities that come with everything, or certainly far more in our daily lives, being networked?
Yes, I think you're not being a Luddite, you're being absolutely wise. For example, I no longer work for Microsoft, so I can say this now, but I am worried, for example, by you have many versions of Android. Actually, they're not patched with the vulnerabilities that everybody's finding bugs in code because it's difficult to write. And then that's exploited by these teams of hackers who actually then go and find your bank account. Mm. And the fact that something like, you know, Apple and Microsoft keep a very controlled thing and they send out corrections and updates and keep your things patched. There's so many versions of Android that that's not so easy. And then you have these apps that you just download, and they're free apps. Well, maybe they're finding out information about you. Why do they need to know for their particular app where you are? They actually access your location. You need to worry about all these things. And so I do get paranoid about downloading free apps because somebody's got to make a living somehow. And I do believe that you're putting yourself at risk if you don't know where the app comes from, you don't actually know what it does in the background, and all the things that it could collect. No, it's a very scary future. And of course, in the book, I talk a little bit about Stuxnet, which is a blueprint for how you attack industrial control systems. It's really scary. You've seen these movies about all the power systems have attacked and things like that. That's not so fanciful. And that really actually can be a serious problem. And I personally also share your worries.
Tony Hay, and the Computing Universe is published by Cambridge University Press. That's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Tony Hay, and from me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.